Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn.
Melanoma is a serious public health problem.
That is Dr. Allie Grossman. She says melanoma is the most dangerous type of skin cancer. And according to the National Institutes of Health, it is the leading cause of death from skin disease. It usually starts as a single skin tumor, but cancer cells can spread or metastasize to sites throughout the body. Most commonly, it spreads to the liver, the lungs, bones, and brain. How melanoma spreads is a puzzle scientists are still trying to solve. Today on the program, Dr. Allie Grossman joins us to talk about new research that offers clues.
I am a pathologist at the University of Utah and ARUP Laboratory in the Department of Pathology, and I do research in the molecular medicine program.
Grossman moved to Utah in 2007 to complete medical residency training in anatomic pathology and stayed here for a postdoctoral position at the laboratory of Dr. Dean Lee in the molecular medicine program at the University of Utah.
And I'm currently finishing up one last clinical year doing molecular genetic pathology fellowship at ARUP.
What inspired you to pursue a career in medicine and particularly pathology?
I think I was inspired to pursue a career in medicine in college just from studying human biology. And I had always thought I was going to be actually a large animal veterinarian. And then in college, I was seduced, so to speak, into human biology. I found it quite fascinating, particularly genetics and molecular biology. That's probably also where my interest in cancer biology first arose. And then after college, I worked as a research assistant in the laboratory of Mike Liskay at Oregon Health Sciences University in a laboratory that studied hereditary colon cancer. That was a very enriching experience in understanding molecular biology and genetics and how that relates to human disease and cancer. And then I went to medical school and also graduate school in the MD-PhD program at Oregon Health Sciences University. And in graduate school, I studied cancer again. I studied specific proteins that drive cancer called tyrosine kinases. I was in the laboratory of Brian Druker at Oregon Health Sciences University, and he was very inspiring, and the work that they were doing was very inspiring. Dr. Druker is well known for the development of the targeted therapy called Gleevec, for chronic myelogenous leukemia and for gastrointestinal stromal tumors. And he really worked closely with Ciba Geigy, which then was bought out by Novartis, to develop really our first breakthrough molecularly targeted therapy for treating cancer. And that drug has performed very well and is really the model for molecularly targeted therapy in cancer. So I had a couple of really inspiring experiences in cancer research labs in Oregon.
In medical school in Oregon, her interest in the molecular genetics of cancer and in developing targeted therapies continued to grow.
I took every possible cancer-related rotation I could when I was in medical school, whether it was a surgery rotation or a medical oncology rotation or any of the other field, obstetrics and gynecology. Just at every juncture and every rotation, I learned as much about the clinical aspects of cancer as possible, and really fell in love with pathology because I'm a very visual learner. And under the microscope, I like looking at tumors, basically, because I can learn a lot about how they grow and how they spread. You see not only the tumor spreading, but you see the body's response to that. You can see the body try to wall off that invasive process with scar tissue. And so you see the immune system. You see inflammatory cells coming in to try to fight those tumor cells. There's a variety of things we see under the microscope.
Melanoma Melanoma is the sixth most common cancer in the United States. Approximately 1 in 50 people will develop it in their lifetime, and the number of melanoma cases diagnosed each year is increasing faster than for any other type of cancer. Dr. Grossman says the key to treating melanoma is to catch it early.
But the problem is catching it early is very difficult because it metastasizes. So once a melanoma reaches about 1 millimeter in the skin,
that is roughly only the size of the tip of a fine point Sharpie marking pen.
It gains access to the lymphatic system very rapidly and metastasizes. So as a pathologist, my job, if I'm looking at a skin specimen with melanoma in it, is to actually measure the depth of the tumor because that changes prognosis for the patient and it changes clinical management.
Dr. Grossman is making headway in her quest to help improve our understanding of the cellular machinery responsible for melanoma metastasis, with the goal of identifying therapies that may stop the spread of cancer cells. So far in her collaborative work, Dr. Grossman and a team of researchers have identified a critical protein role in the metastasis of melanoma. Inhibition of the protein, referred to as ARF6 for short, reduces the spread of melanoma to the lungs in mice, according to a study published in the March 5th issue of Science Signaling Online. The inference is that targeting ARF6 may be an effective approach to preventing melanoma metastasis. Dr. Grossman explains how this study got its start and the details of their findings.
So the first thing I did when I started residency here was actually try to find a mentor who could help me study cancer metastasis. That was my number one research agenda when I came as a resident, was to find a lab where I could study metastasis and hopefully try to figure out how to prevent metastasis. And I had heard a dean give a talk about our blood vessels and how they can be leaky in different inflammatory disease settings. And it occurred to me that, you know, what a great opportunity to study metastasis in a laboratory where the scientists are experts in what controls our blood vessels, because that's really how cancer cells spread, is they get into the lymphatics and the blood vessels and to travel to distant organs. And so I took a chance and went to a laboratory that was quite successful from a researcher's perspective, but had not attempted very much to venture into cancer biology. And it turned out to be a great partnership with a lot of expertise in the lab that I could then learn from myself and use the expertise there to really make progress in cancer model systems. And, you know, doing science is like raising children. It requires a village, as some famous person, Hillary Clinton, has said before. It takes a team of people and a lot of work from people with different expertise. So I put myself in that position to be surrounded by very accomplished, very hardworking, and generous scientists. And so there was really a group of us. And then we have investigators at Notre Dame who also made pretty significant contributions. But basically, what we have uncovered is the machinery that a tumor cell can use to become mobile, to disconnect from the attachments where it's anchored down in the tissue where it arose from, to pull up those anchors and disconnect and start moving and gaining access to local tissue invasion, but then also into the blood vessels to spread.
By closely studying the aggressive cancer cell machinery, they were able to figure out the specific protein responsible for the cascade of cellular events that lead to metastasis.
They secrete a protein called WNT5A, and it has been reported in the literature before that this protein is pertinent to disease progression in melanoma. So in patient samples, it has been shown that melanomas that produce this protein tend to be more metastatic. They progress more rapidly in patients and lead to worse outcomes. So we found that when we were working with human melanoma cell lines, that some of these cell lines expressed abundant amounts. They produced a lot of this WNT5A protein. And that was the initiating signal that activated in a stepwise manner a number of downstream events that ultimately led to tumor cell motility and metastasis. So we were able to come in and tease apart some of the key elements downstream, the key protein, the machinery downstream of WNT5A signaling, and specifically a protein called ARF6. It's a very small protein within a cell, and it orchestrates a number of events. It actually can integrate pro-migratory signals from proteins called WNT5A, but also it can respond to inhibitory signals from a protein and ligand and receptor complex called SLIT and ROBO. And so it really is like this integrative switch. It can be turned on or off to make a cell mobile. And that's an advantage for a cancer cell because it allows a cancer cell, when it needs to move to a more growth-promoting environment where there's more nutrients, it can move. Then when it's found a sort of a nutrient-rich environment, it can now stop migrating and start carrying on other cellular functions like proliferation. So cells need to have very dynamic control over movement, cancer cells, to be able to survive and to grow. And so this protein, ARF6, allows that. But the initiating signal comes from proteins like WNT5A, and that was part of our discovery, that WNT5A activates ARF6 to get melanoma cells to migrate and invade and metastasize. And the other key thing of this study was we were able to target this small protein, ARF6, with a small molecule inhibitor called second H3. And when we did this in mice, we actually dramatically significantly slowed down metastasis. We had less mice with spontaneous melanoma metastasis, and within the mice that had metastasis, there were less metastatic foci.
How would you apply this to humans, and how far down the road?
This is preliminary preclinical data. This is a brand new pathway that's been described. And so what we need to do is see how prevalent this pathway is. ARF6 is a protein that is expressed in all cell types, but we need to see how relevant is this in really a population of patient samples and use the tools that we have to see whether this is really as common a pathway as we think it is. And then we need to develop better inhibitors. The small molecule inhibitor we used is really not amenable for patient care.
Dr. Grossman and Dean Lee's lab at the U of U are collaborating with a local pharmaceutical company called Navigen to develop better ARF6 inhibitors, and they will be testing them in various cancer models. She is excited about the research for several reasons.
First and foremost, our findings in melanoma are likely to also be applicable in other cancer types. So cancer cells from different origins have a tendency to really exploit the same pathways in slightly different ways. So we think that ARF6 likely controls tumor cell motility, invasion, and metastasis in multiple cancer cell types, and we'll be exploring that. So it's exciting for cancer research in general when a new pathway is discovered, especially when it's potentially targetable. It's also exciting because in melanoma specifically, melanoma is an extremely aggressive cancer, and there have been some very exciting discoveries and advancements in the treatment for metastatic melanoma, and there's been rapid progress in the last few years in advancement of treatment for melanoma. But the treatments that we have try to kill the existing tumors by inhibiting their growth or getting the immune system to attack those tumors. But unfortunately, while we get a nice response in these patients, it's usually not durable. It's really almost, it's very rare that we get long-term survivorship with the current systemic treatment for advanced stage melanoma. Very, very small percentage of those patients will actually have long-term survivorship. And so what is lethal to these patients is disease progression when their melanoma, which is already maybe an advanced stage, but it continues to spread to vital organs such as the brain and the lungs and the liver. That is what ends up being lethal to patients. And so we know a lot about how to kill the growth of tumors, but we don't know how to stop their spread. This is a pathway where we can potentially, you know, combine treatment with agents that target tumor cell growth with anti-metastatic agents and have two different mechanisms to treat patients with advanced stage disease.
Do you know why certain types of cancers, particularly melanoma, will tend to spread to certain parts of the body?
That's a very broad base of investigation by a number of scientists really around the world. And there's a number of hypotheses out there as to why certain cancers are drawn to certain organs. The lungs are thought to be a common site of metastasis because it's very vascular and rich in small capillaries. So it's thought that, you know, tumor cells, once they get into the bloodstream, the first place they go is to the heart and lungs. And then that's a very oxygen-rich, nutrient-rich environment where tumor cells can set up shop and start growing. You know, once tumor cells make it into the bloodstream, all the blood is carried eventually back to the heart and the lungs. So the lungs are also, they have a lot of tiny little capillaries, so tumor cells get stuck in those tiny little capillaries. But, you know, that's only probably part of the answer to the question. And what you're asking is something that we don't know all the answers to yet. Melanoma is a little bit unique. It certainly has a predilection for liver and lung and brain. However, melanoma is often called the great masquerader, more so than many other cancers. It has the capacity to really metastasize earlier in disease and also to more sites. It's really one of the most aggressive cancers out there.
That was Dr. Allie Grossman. To learn more about melanoma, she recommends searching these websites.
There's information about melanoma at the website for the National Cancer Institute. There's information about melanoma and screening programs and melanoma treatment at Huntsman Cancer Institute websites. And I would refer patients to those websites for information and just encourage everyone to go get a skin check and wear lots of sunblock.
Thank you for listening. Sherry Quinn, Access Utah.
Firefly burning bright for you two tonight.
Did you know that positive coping strategies can help slow the progression of Alzheimer's disease and dementia? So, if you are a caregiver, take care of yourself, count your blessings, and ask for help when you need it.
Did You Know That is made possible by the USU Emma Eccles Jones College of Education and Human Services. More at cehs.usu.edu.
Support for Science Questions comes from the College of Science at Utah State University, where graduates' acceptance rates to medical, dental, and graduate schools exceed national averages. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information at usu.edu/science. Support also comes from the Iron Gate Inn B&B and Winery. Amenities include 9 guest rooms, garden patios for dining, and on-site wine tasting. In Cedar City, 2 blocks from the Utah Shakespeare Festival. The Iron Gate Inn, online at theirongateinn.com.
Chasing Ice, directed by Jeff Orlowski, is the powerful climate change film, nominated for a 2013 Oscar for its original song, Before My Time.
Cold feet, don't fail me now. So much left to do. If I should run 10,000 miles home, would you be there?
The film follows National Geographic photographer James Balog's quest to document the melting of the world's Arctic glaciers. The film premiered at the 2012 Sundance Film Festival and won the Excellence in Cinematography Award. This is Science Questions. I'm Sherry Quinn.
And I am Susie Montgomery.
I don't want to die alone, way before my time.
Today on the program, we profile this documentary film with Balog and Orlowski. I talked to them about their film in Park City at the 2012 festival. For Sundance program director Caroline Labresco, the visuals of the film were stunning and haunting. Images she says she will never forget.
Thinking about substance, right before moderating a Q&A, I love to get into the room 5 or 10 minutes early, even though I've often seen a film once or twice before, I don't need to look at it again, but I love to see the last few minutes and really observe what the audience is experiencing and what the feeling is in the room. And with Chasing Ice, I was really struck. I turned around and looked at the audience, and over 400-seat theater, the Library Theater here in Park City, and every seat was taken, and you could hear a pin drop in the audience. I mean, they were riveted to the screen, and some people were just, their mouths were hanging open as they witness, in the final scenes of the film, a very, very dramatic moment where a glacier the size of Lower Manhattan is detaching from a larger piece of ice, and it's a massive and shocking and highly rare thing to catch on camera.
It was like watching a gigantic ship sink. Suddenly, right before our eyes, the thing broke off, flipped over, and drifted out into the ocean. Rock!
So everything we're trying is getting thwarted.
It's all about the electronics not wanting to work.
Oh, happy day. It's all there.
In the Extreme Ice Survey, we're making a unique record of a unique moment in geologic time.
Acclaimed National Geographic photographer James Balog admits that in the 90s, he was a climate change skeptic. But since he embarked on what he has called the Extreme Ice Survey, he is absolutely convinced no one is crying wolf. In Chasing Ice, Balog uses time-lapse images to prove the world's glaciers are melting dramatically at a rapid pace. The rare footage he caught on tape brings the dull statistics, percentages, the math, and the science to life.
I can't wait to see those cameras. It's been 10 weeks since they were put out. And in the meantime, the Mendenhall's had the biggest cycle of calving that anybody's ever seen here in 45 years. So we should have amazing results on those cameras.
Oh, fantastic.
We have 1,577 frames. It's been working the entire time. It's a beautiful thing.
This is it, ground zero. More ice is released into the global ocean from this glacier than any other glacier in the northern hemisphere. If sea level rises, this is where it all begins. This is it, ground zero.
In the spring of 2007, Balog and a team of adventurers, including Chasing Ice film director Jeff Orlowski, hiked and climbed all over the northern hemisphere to do time-lapse photography, an idea Balog got after his first expedition north, where he succeeded in designing and deploying weatherproof time-lapse cameras, each powered by the sun. He placed them in Alaska, Greenland and the Canadian Rockies, Iceland, the Andes and Bolivia, and more recently on Mount Everest. The cameras take pictures on average every hour, and he spent over 5 years in the field. Balog notes that this is only half of his job. The other half is to inform the public.
He calls ice the canary in the global coal mine, the place where we can see, touch, hear, and feel climate change in action, otherwise abstract. Where we all wonder, is it getting hotter, colder, wetter, drier? It's real and present and highly visible, according to Balog. 95% of the glaciers outside of Antarctica are retreating because precipitation patterns and temperature patterns are changing. And that, he confirms, is bomb-proof information.
Balog's graphs of a 400,000-year-old record undoubtedly show that we are way outside the natural variability of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, 280 parts per million being the all-time peak before now. Today, we are at an astounding 385 parts per million. In Balog's words, Earth has a fever that is climbing, outstripping any predictions a few years ago.
Chasing ice is the story of one man's sheer determination to capture the beauty and the horror of our changing planet. The visually stunning film of ice islands, crashing glaciers, and massive ice canyons all started when Balog heard about the talented and eager young filmmaker Jeff Orlowski in 2007.
He was still an undergrad. He was still finishing his senior year when he went on the first trip to Iceland.
It was cold. It was very cold. And I had never done anything like that before. I'd done a lot of camping, a lot of outdoor stuff, but it was such a foreign concept going to Iceland in the wintertime. And I brought many, many layers, and I was still underprepared in terms of the right gear and the right layers for warmth and the right camera equipment and the right covers and protection for the cameras. But you learn fast in those conditions, and you learn, you know, what you need to have. And David Bashirs, who was on the shoot with us, he gave me a pair of shell pants, and I wore those every single day the entire week and wore holes in the knee pads and stuff. And it was a trying trip for the first time.
Within months of that first trip to Iceland, the photographer conceived the boldest expedition of his life, the Extreme Ice Survey. With a band of young adventurers in tow, Balog began deploying revolutionary time-lapse cameras across the brutal Arctic to capture a multi-year record of the world's changing glaciers.
Well, the idea for the project has been boiling around in my head since the late 90s, actually. So we're, you know, well over a dozen years worth of thinking about how the story of climate change must be in the ice. And yet I didn't know how to photograph the ice in a really interesting way, or at least a way that was going to keep me entertained and that seemed like something other than just routine beauty shots. And in 2005, I had an assignment from The New Yorker to do a story on climate change. And one of the shots was to be on a glacier. And that actually took me to Iceland. And I realized from that work that there were parts on these glaciers that revealed to you in a really unexpected way how the landscape was changing. You know, you could see it really acutely at some of those sites. And so then I came back with that experience in my head and proposed to National Geographic that we should go and work on this one glacier and just do repeat shots of positions shot 6 months apart. And when I came back from the first of those trips, they said, well, we're going to make this a global story on changing glaciers. Would you like to do it? So I shot that story. And this is now at the end of 2006. We're editing those pictures. And I thought, you know, we really should go back to a lot of those same glaciers and some other ones and make a sequential record of how the places are changing. And single frame photography, conventional, you know, snapshots are not enough. We ought to try time lapse. And I thought at first I was doing maybe just a couple time lapse cameras, and all of a sudden I got the wild idea that maybe 25 was a good idea. And the rest is history.
Balog and his team cleverly engineered the cameras to work in extremely harsh conditions, and they were surprised by the results of their designs.
In Greenland, we're looking at temperatures that are, you know, for weeks at a time down in the minus 30 range and in some cases down to minus 40 and colder. And the cameras need to be able to work as long as possible, and eventually the electrons actually freeze and the shutters freeze and nothing works anymore. But they need to be able to come back alive after they've been frozen. So that's a key part. You have to have a structural support to protect the thing from the wind and rockfall and things like that. So we had to design all of that. And the winds, by the way, in places like the Continental Divide in Montana, the wind goes to 150 miles an hour a couple times a winter. So, I mean, it's just really intense winds. I mean, you don't see hurricanes that are like that. That's tornado-grade wind speeds. So it has to survive that. And then they get deep snowfall, they get torrential rains, and it's pretty rough conditions. It's not good for electronics. On top of that, we needed to invent a timer that was suitable for these applications to tell the camera when to fire. And so each camera shoots roughly 8,000 frames a year. So there were a lot of things that needed to be worked out. I had thought that we would just, you know, buy this stuff off the shelf, put it together, and it would be no big deal. I had no idea how difficult it would be to really do this right, but it worked out.
Thick snowflakes were falling like cotton balls as I walked into the condo where Alaski was staying with his parents, friends, and crew members. I was warmly greeted with a room full of smiles, bowls brimming with steamed vegetables and rice, and a plate of chocolate chip cookies. Their down-to-earth demeanor made me feel instantly at ease and at home, so the butterflies in my stomach went away. Admittedly, I was nervous to meet and interview this iconic photographer, artist, scientist, and documentarian. He gave me a warm pat on the shoulder, and in my mind, it was as if he was saying, "Hey, it's okay, relax, we're cool." I could see why he had such a dedicated and successful crew during the extreme ice survey.
James is very dedicated and passionate and obsessive, and all I had to do was keep up with him, which was tough, but that was basically the main objective, just keep following him and just try to keep up. And he pushes himself to such a high level and a high standard for quality that I think it rubs off onto everybody on the team. We have our own high expectations, not only for ourselves, but likewise just for James's sake and for James's level of standards. I think all of us strive to do our best, and James brought that out of all of us, the whole team, to really do our best work and make this as strong as it could be. When things got tough, when the weather was bad, when all the conditions were terrible, when the computers failed, when the editing was tough, it was just a matter of needing to continue because we knew we had this vision for the end in sight, and we just had to get there somehow.
That vision was key to surviving in one of the most extreme environments on the planet.
There's this one story that I like to tell. It was this one trip we did in Greenland in the wintertime, and we were in this cabin and our heater wasn't working. And the outside temperatures were about negative 30 to negative 40 that week. The heater was leaking propane. We could smell the gas in the room, so we decided to turn it off, and we went to sleep without the heater on. I was in two sleeping bags and had a down jacket over me, and I woke up in the middle of the night because my teeth were chattering so loud that's what woke me up. And it was pitch black out. I had no idea what time it was. The other guys were on a different bunk. And I was waiting for the sun to come up just so I could get up and move my body around, bearing through the cold until the sun came up in the morning.
It felt like we were traveling to another planet a lot of the time. You know, yeah, we used helicopters a lot. We also used boats, fishing boats. We used canoes. We used skis, crampons, dog sleds, rappelling down into crevasses. It was pretty lively. And one of the things that we really don't tell the story of very much was dog sledding out there in Greenland in the wintertime. And we had to take our how many sleds and dogs did we have?
Four sleds.
Four sleds, yeah.
16 to 18 dogs per sled.
Yeah, so we had this huge wolf pack of these wild Greenland huskies. And we had to climb up over a 2,000-foot-high mountain range with the sleds. And then we went down the other side, down into this fjord, and then skied up to where one of the camera sites was to see how the gear was doing in the wintertime. And long story short, on the way back, you have to come back down this mountain range. And it gets blasted by the wind. And that snow is just like ice. It's really, really hard where it goes down over the rocks. So you're sitting in this dog sled, and you're going about 30 miles an hour down that hill with no protection. I mean, you're literally just hanging on the ropes on the dog sled, bouncing over these big rock outcrops and these blocks of ice. And we had a couple of really exciting dog sled wrecks. And you could easily, that was probably the most, along with the helicopters, that was the most dangerous part of the whole trip. I don't worry about going in the crevasses nearly as much as I worried about having a crash on there and somebody breaking their neck on those sleds. Well,
we had a team of four of us traveling on the dog sleds, and each one of us crashed at different times, and all to varying degrees of kind of the show of the crash. But we captured one or two of them on film, which are in the movie.
Then there was the hungover helicopter pilot, who perhaps gave them the biggest scare of their adventure, who made rappelling vertically down massive ice canyons that led to raging ice-cold rivers seem like a cakewalk.
You never know how well somebody's focused on taking care of your life. And so since you are out of control and you're dependent on that other guy, it can be a bit nerve-wracking. This village called Uminak in north-central Greenland, and it's tiny little Inuit fishing village out in this little harbor, and they have this little landing pad built on a slab of rock. And we were flying on a Saturday morning, and the mechanic who was in charge of the helicopter was hung over from the night before. And so we've got all this equipment next to the helicopter, some in the helicopter, some around the helicopter. Mechanic comes, and he's a mess from drinking too much, and he puts the nozzle in the fuel tank and walks away. Turns it on and walks away. And there's this jet fuel A pumping into the helicopter. And that stuff stinks. It's really nasty to smell. And so it's pumping. He goes away. We're loading our stuff. We're taking pictures. We're doing whatever. And all of a sudden we realize there's like a flood of gasoline all over the equipment, all over the helicopter, all over the asphalt. And finally, this half-drunk guy comes staggering out and turns it off, and we're thinking, okay, is this going to explode? And what happens next? And, you know, so it makes you worried about the quality of service that you might be getting. We also had a really, really extremely scary helicopter flight up there that first year when Jason Box and I were deploying cameras. We were trying to fly in under a cloud ceiling to get up on this ridge where the camera needed to be placed. We already had like an hour's worth of flying time invested in getting to the site and discovered we couldn't climb up in a normal fashion out of these clouds. So the pilot said, well, I can see a little hole of light up through that gully in the rocks over there. So he just flew the helicopter right up to the front edge of the cliff and just followed up through the clouds. You know, you couldn't see but 20 feet in front of you. He was right at the limits of visibility. He just kind of slowly climbed up in this little chimney, right up and up and up and up and up for 1,000 feet. And those rotors had no more than 8 feet of clearance on either side of those rotors. And we eventually got up, and there was a flat spot, and he landed us right there, and he said, I'm getting out of here, because if I stay here more than 2 minutes, I don't know if it'll close in, and I won't get out of here at all. It was really gripping.
Each trip usually lasted a few weeks, but they had to prepare for anything to happen. They knew they could get stuck out there for much longer, maybe forever. And it was not always the bad weather that held them captive in the ice.
There was one trip in particular where the weather was bad, and so the helicopter couldn't come pick us up. And you're literally out in the middle of nowhere, and you get a call on your satellite phone saying, oh, sorry, we can't come get you, just sit tight. And I was stuck out there for an extra day or two on one trip with you, and you had a separate trip where you were stuck for about a week just because of bad weather. And they have so many flights booked. They have flights booked. All the helicopters are booked for oil exploration. So that's kind of an interesting poetry there. But they have all of the commercial helicopter flights chartered and reserved for oil exploration. So months in advance. So if you miss your time window on a flight due to bad weather, they actually put you at the end of the line. And only when they have a gap in their scheduling do they come pick you up.
To the average eye, I suppose the scariest stuff we were doing was getting down in those crevasses in those channels called moulins, M-O-U-L-I-N-S. They're like these big canyons get chiseled out by the meltwater rivers that flow across the ice sheet. And I look at some of those scenes in the film and I just question my sanity. But at the time, it really kind of made sense. You know, we could look at the problem. But, you know, when you're there, you go, okay, well, I see the problem. I see what the tactics might be. Do we have the right equipment? Do we have the right skills? Do we make the right plan? And maybe it takes you a couple of days sometimes to make the right plan for how you're going to manage the situation. But then you kind of put all the pieces together and you go and methodically you do it. And you're always doing a little reality check with yourself saying, okay, did we think of all the mistakes that can happen? Did we think of all the problems? If something bad happens, like the rope gets snagged over here, how am I getting out? If that balcony collapses over there, what happens next? And you say, okay, I have a plan for that. And you go and you do it. And then after the fact, you look at some of those scenes and you think that's completely mad. Why would you do such a thing? But you get possessed, or I get possessed, by a great picture. And I just kind of keep following what's out there until I get the shot.
One thing that I have to commend James on is that he has a very high regard for safety. As improbable as it may seem from some of that footage, like I think he has always kept in mind the team safety and everybody being well trained and knowing how to deal with the circumstances, knowing how to deal with problem scenarios. Traveling on ice can be dangerous if somebody falls into a crevasse and you have to be roped to each other and you have to know how to pull somebody out if need be, because your life is literally hanging on a rope to your friend's life. And we did a lot of training back in Boulder, and we were out on cliffs where James, Adam, and myself were learning how to do Z-pulley rigs and actually hauled people up off of cliffs just to do all these rehearsals and do the practices. If something went wrong, if somebody fell into a crevasse, knowing how to do a self-arrest, you stop yourself, you set up an anchor, and you rig a system so we can pull them out. So we spent a lot of time talking about safety and how to deal with different scenarios. And I think in part because, you know, James is there and the rest of the team were these younger guys. And I presume he had the sense of responsibility, not only in leading the team, but also being the oldest one in the group. But I think we all tried to maintain and respect that. And I always felt safe. I never felt like my life was in jeopardy other than in that chopper.
You know, it's funny, we've never talked about that, but that was always a thing that weighed on me a lot, the burden of making sure that everybody was safe and that we were all coming out of there in one piece. And I remember going on one of those Greenland trips just a couple days before we left. Your father was at your house, and he said to me, "Take good care of my son. He's the only one I have." Yeah, that was pretty heavy, you know, and I always kept that in mind. Yeah, I try and think about 25 steps ahead, you know, and yeah, sometimes you still get surprised, but you do your best.
This is another thing that I feel like I've learned from James quite a bit. And the way he's always approached his work is trying to not just make a pretty photograph or pretty image, but that it has meaning and that it has emotional resonance. That it's not enough just to make a pretty photograph. You have to accomplish these multiple goals with it if it's going to succeed at the highest artistic and potentially conceptual levels. And so I think that it really is all of the different facets of James's career and his experience in the photography world and the mountaineering world that all led to this project and led to this very unique perspective of wanting to capture history of glaciers. And I think that's what created the resonance and the impact that it has. I think that's not that it's what created it, but that those were necessary for this project to be born. And it took the perspective of a guy who studied geomorphology and studied how landscape changed and knew the history and the life and breadth of glaciers to come up with this concept. And I think that's why it has that resonance. When you watch these things, it shows you the world in a way that nobody ever envisioned before, nobody really felt before. And not only is it accomplishing that task, but it's also telling us something really important about how the climate is changing. And I think it's a combination of all of those factors that gives the time lapses its impact.
What I would add is that these pictures combine an artistic sensibility and a scientific sensibility. And it's important to recognize that because they're really reflecting the two different kinds of human experience and the two different halves of the human brain. You know, we have a right brain and a left brain. And the, what is it, the left brain is the more rational, and the right brain is the more intuitive. And art is on that right brain side, and science is on that left brain side. And if you were to go out and just do a time-lapse picture of a glacier, you'd go, okay, on an aesthetic level, that's pretty interesting. But what makes that picture even way more interesting is that it's embedded in a continuum of scientific knowledge and experience and understanding that gives that time-lapse picture a meaning and purpose and resonance. So similarly, the art brings the science alive, because science by itself is really, really dry, you know, infamously dry. So many science projects about glaciers result in a graph. That's it. You try and measure things, collect a lot of numbers, and turn that understanding into a graph of time versus a number. And that's really exciting to scientists, but it isn't very exciting to anybody else. So we bring the science alive with the artistic interpretation as well. So the two things work together, art and science, left brain, right brain, rationality and intuition, aesthetics and quantitative study. We get excited and captivated by seeing these spectacularly improbable, dramatic things happening, or these dramatic landscapes, and you get really excited about that. But then another part of your brain says, oh my God, this is just horrendous. This is terrible. You know, what it means underneath the surface of appearances is so serious for civilization that you almost feel guilty for being excited that you captured a great calving event, because it really is not a great story, you know. But it's, as a photographer, you have this opportunity to use your energies and talents and tools to reveal something that needs to be revealed, that's historically important, that can shift people's emotions and perceptions. And so you kind of go on in spite of the schizophrenia.
His images are simply beautiful, but they can also be haunting because they are telling us a story, the story of accelerated climate change.
I find it enormously easy to get depressed about this. And I get upset and depressed at the human race at least once a day. I mean, it's with me all the time. But I kind of will myself not to be depressed for the sake of A, my sanity, B, my daughter's future. I have a 10-year-old and I have a 23-year-old. And I don't want to see them growing up in a degraded world. I want to see them growing up in a world of opportunity where there's not a lot of extra stress added to the normal stresses of life, a lot of extra stress that's added by the social chaos, the military chaos, the extra costs that are going to come from all of the problems that derive from climate change. I don't want to see that. And for the sake of our self-respect, the self-respect of the people alive here today, I think we need to be conscious of adding a quality environment, passing on a quality environment, a high quality of life to the people who come after us. We don't have a right. We don't have a privilege to completely destroy this place for the sake of our own short-term pleasures and profits. It's wrong. That's not the way the world is meant to be. The world is meant to be lived in on a more sensible and sustainable basis.
Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn, Susie Montgomery, and Elaine Taylor. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to the Beehive Archive, a two-minute look at some of the most pivotal and peculiar events in Utah's history. I'm Megan Van Frank. This week, listen to the adventure of Bobby Donahue, a Park City boy who, at the age of 13, ran away to fight in the 1898 Spanish-American War. First this.
The Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by the Utah Humanities Council, with support from a We the People grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation.
Any parent who has ever lost a youngster in a crowd can imagine Park City resident Bridget Donahue's panic when she couldn't find her 13-year-old son, Bobby. Believing he had gone to nearby Heber in the fall of 1898, Bridget must have been very surprised when she learned that Bobby had actually traveled all the way to the Philippine Islands in the western Pacific Ocean. In fact, when Bobby Donahue returned the following year, he wore a military uniform and was the youngest unofficial veteran of the Spanish-American War. The United States declared war on Spain on April 25, 1898, after the USS Maine exploded in Havana Harbor in February. Likely inspired by newspaper reports of the war and a boy's patriotic sense of adventure, Bobby boarded a westbound train, determined to participate in the grand little war before it ended. After reaching San Francisco, he stowed aboard a ship bound for the Philippines, but was found out and tossed off the steamer before it departed. Undeterred, he snuck back on board and remained hidden until the ship set sail. Becoming hungry, Bobby emerged from hiding and was discovered by the ship's captain. When the ship finally reached Manila, Bobby remained locked in a cabin. Still determined to join the war, he removed the rubber tubing from his porthole, jumped into the water, and swam to shore. When he found friends from Park City among the American troops, they declared Bobby their official mascot, and he remained with his Utah comrades for the majority of the war. Though it occurred before 24-hour news coverage, local newspapers loved the story. When the company returned to Utah in August 1899, Bobby, or Robert as he had matured into, received a hero's welcome. We don't know what happened when his mother got a hold of him, but in November, Bobby Donahue received a Medal of Honor from Utah's first state governor, Heber M. Wells. Research and writing for this episode of the Beehive Archive were done by Emily Beeson. Sources and past episodes may be found at utahhumanities.org. For the Beehive Archive, a production of the Utah Humanities Council, I'm Megan Van Frank.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from listeners and from Apogee Instruments of Cache Valley, creating innovative sensors for measuring climate change, sustainable food production, and renewable energy. More information is at apogeeinstruments.com. Support also comes from the Utah Humanities Council, empowering Utahns to improve their communities through the humanities, online at utahhumanities.org. It's currently 48 degrees on the USU campus. It's 10 o'clock.